he might ignore her, or worse, turn hateful again, and send her weeping from the table. Instead, Joffrey smiled and kissed her hand, handsome and gallant as any prince in the songs, and said, "Sir Loras has a keen eye for beauty, sweet lady." "He was too kind," she demurred, trying to remain modest and calm, though her heart was singing. "Sir Loras is a true knight. Do you think he will win tomorrow, my lord?" "No," Geoffrey said. "My dog will do for him, or perhaps my uncle Jamie. And in a few years, when I'm old enough to enter the lists, I shall do for them all." He raised his hand to summon a servant with a flagon of iced summer wine and poured her a cup. She looked anxiously at Septa Mordaine, until Joffrey leaned over and filled the Septa's cup as well. So she nodded and thanked him graciously and said not another word. The servants kept their cups filled all night, yet afterwards Sansa could not recall ever tasting the wine. She needed no wine. She was drunk on the magic of that night, giddy with glamour, swept away by beauties she had dreamt of all her life and never dared hope to know. Singers sat before the king's pavilion, filling the dusk with music. A juggler kept a cascade of burning clubs spinning through the air. The king's own fool, the pie-faced simpleton called Moonboy, danced about on stilts, all in motley, making mock of everyone with such deft cruelty that Sansa wondered if he was simple after all. Even Septa Mordaine was helpless before him. When he sang his little song about the High Septon, she laughed so loud she spilled wine on herself. And Joffrey was the soul of courtesy. He talked to Sansa all night, showering her with compliments, making her laugh, sharing little bits of court gossip, explaining Moonboy's japes. Sansa was so captivated that she quite forgot all her courtesies and ignored Septa Mordaine seated to her left. All the while the courses came and went, a thick soup of barley and venison, salads of sweet grass and spinach and plums sprinkled with crushed nuts, snails in honey and garlic. Sansa had never eaten snails before. Joffrey showed her how to get the snail out of the shell and fed her the first sweet morsel himself. Then came trout, fresh from the river, baked in clay. Her prince helped her crack open the hard casing to expose the flaky, white flesh within. And when the meat course was brought out, he served to himself, slicing a queen's portion from the joint, smiling as he laid it on her plate. She could see from the way he moved that his right arm was still troubling him, yet he uttered not a word of complaint. Later came sweetbreads and pigeon pie and baked apples fragrant with cinnamon and lemon cakes frosted in sugar. But by then Sansa was so stuffed that she could not manage more than two little lemon cakes, as much as she loved them. She was wondering whether she might attempt a third when the king began to shout. King Robert had grown louder with each course. From time to time Sansa could hear him laughing or roaring a command over the music and the clangor of plates and cutlery, but they were too far away for her to make out his words. Now everyone heard him. "No!" he thundered, in a voice that drowned out all other speech. Sansa was shocked to see the king on his feet, red of face, reeling. He had a goblet of wine in one hand, and he was drunk as a man could be. "You do not tell me what to do, woman!" he screamed at Queen Cersei. "I am king here. Do you understand? I rule here, and if I say that I will fight tomorrow, I will fight." Everyone was staring. Sansa saw Sir Barristan and the king's brother Renly, and the short man who had talked to her so oddly and touched her hair, but no one made a move to interfere. The queen's face was a mask, so bloodless that it might have been sculpted from snow. She rose from the table, gathered her skirts around her, and stormed off in silence, servants trailing behind. Jaime Lannister put a hand on the king's shoulder, but the king shoved him away hard. Lannister stumbled and fell. The king guffawed. "The great knight! I can still knock you in the dirt. Remember that, Kingslayer?" He slapped his chest with his jeweled goblet, splashing wine all over his satin tunic. "Give me my hammer, and not a man in the realm can stand before me." Jaime Lannister rose and brushed himself off. "As you say, Your Grace." His voice was stiff. Lord Renly came forward, smiling. "You've spilled your wine, Robert. Let me fetch you a fresh goblet." Sansa started as Joffrey laid a hand on her arm. "It grows late," the prince said. He had a queer look in his face, as if he were not seeing her at all. "Do you need an escort back to the castle?" "No," Sansa began. She looked for Septa Mordaine, and was startled to find her, with her head on the table, snoring soft and ladylike snores. "I mean to say, yes, thank you, that would be most kind. I am tired, and the way is so dark. I should be glad for some protection." Joffrey called out, "Dog!" Sandor Clegane seemed to take form out of the night, so quickly did he appear. He had exchanged his armour for a red woolen tunic with a leather dog's head sewn on the front. The light of the torches made his burned face shine a dull red. "Yes, Your Grace," he said. "Take my betrothed back to the castle, and see that no harm befalls her," the prince told him brusquely, and without even a word of farewell, Joffrey strode off, leaving her there. Sansa could feel the hound watching her. "Did you think Joff was going to take you himself?" he laughed. He had a laugh like the snarling of dogs in a pit. "Small chance of that." He pulled her unresisting to her feet. "Come, you're not the only one who needs sleep. I've drunk too much, and I may need to kill my brother tomorrow." He laughed again. Suddenly terrified, Sansa pushed at Septa Mordaine's shoulder, hoping to wake her, but she only snored the louder. King Robert had stumbled off, and half the benches were suddenly empty. The feast was over, and the beautiful dream had ended with it. The hound snatched up a torch to light their way. Sansa followed close beside him. The ground was rocky and uneven. The flickering light made it seem to shift and move beneath her. She kept her eyes lowered, watching where she placed her feet. They walked among the pavilions, each with its banner and its armour hung outside, the silence weighing heavier with every step. Sansa could not bear the sight of him. He frightened her so. Yet she had been raised in all the ways of courtesy. A true lady would not notice his face, she told herself. "You rode gallantly today, Sir Sandor," she made herself say. Sandor Clegane snarled at her. "Spare me your empty little compliments, girl. And your sirs. I'm no knight. I spit on them, and their vows. My brother is a knight. Did you see him ride today?" "Yes," Sansa whispered, trembling. "He was..." "Gallant," the hound finished. "He was mocking her," she realized. "No one could withstand him," she managed at last, proud of herself. It was no lie. Sandor Clegane stopped suddenly in the middle of a dark and empty field. She had no choice but to stop beside him. "Some scepter trained you well. You're like one of those birds from the Summer Isles, aren't you? Pretty little talking bird, repeating all the pretty little words they taught you to recite." "That's unkind." Sansa could feel her heart fluttering in her chest. "You're frightening me. I want to go now." "No one could withstand him," the hound rasped. "That's truth enough. No one could ever withstand Gregor. That boy today, his second joust, oh, that was a pretty bit of business. You saw that, did you? Fool boy, he had no business riding in this company. No money, no squire, no one to help him with his armour. That gorget wasn't fastened proper. You think Gregor didn't notice that? You think Sir Gregor's lance rode up by chance, do you? Pretty little talking girl, you believe that? You're empty-headed as a bird for true. Gregor's lance goes where Gregor wants it to go. Look at me, look at me!" Sandor Clegane put a huge hand under her chin and forced her face up. He squatted in front of her and moved the torch close. "There's pretty for you. Take a good long stare. You know you want to. I've watched you turning away all the way down the King's Road. piss on that. Take your look. His fingers held her jaw as hard as an iron trap. His eyes watched hers, drunken eyes, sullen with anger. She had to look. The right side of his face was gaunt, with sharp cheekbones and a grey eye beneath a heavy brow. His nose was large and hooked, his hair thin, dark. He wore it long and brushed it sideways because no hair grew on the other side of that face. The left side of his face was a ruin. His ear had been burned away. There was nothing left but a hole. His eye was still good, but all around it was a twisted mass of scar, slick black flesh, hard as leather, pocked with craters and fissured by deep cracks that gleamed red and wet when he moved. Down by his jaw, you could see the hint of bone where the flesh had been seared away. Sansa began to cry. He let go of her then, and snuffed out the torch in the dirt.
No pretty words for that, girl. No little compliment the scepter taught you.
When there was no answer, he continued,
Most of them. They think it was some battle. A siege, a burning tower, an enemy with a torch. One fool asked me if it was dragon's breath.
His laugh was softer this time, but just as bitter.
I'll tell you what it was, girl, he said,
in a voice from the night, a shadow leaning so close now that she could smell the sour stench of wine on his breath.
I was younger than you, 6, maybe 7. A woodcarver set up shop in the village under my father's keep, and to buy a favour, he sent us gifts. The old man made marvellous toys. I don't remember what I got, but it was Gregor's gift I wanted. A wooden knight all painted up, every joint pegged separate, and fixed with strings, so you can make him fight. Gregor is 5 years older than me. A toy was nothing to him. He was already a squire, 6 feet tall and muscled like an ox. So I took his knight. But there was no joy in it, I tell you. I was scared all the while, and true enough, he found me. There was a brazier in the room. Gregor never said a word, just picked me up on his arm and shoved the side of my face down on the burning coals and held me there, while I screamed and screamed. You saw how strong he is. Even then, it took 3 grown men to drag him off me. The Septons preach about the 7 hells. What do they know? Only a man who's been burned knows what hell is truly like. My father told everyone my bedding had caught fire, and our maester gave me ointments. Ointments? Gregor got his ointments, too. 4 years later, they anointed him with the 7 oils, and he recited his nightly vows, and Rhaegar Targaryen tapped him on his shoulder and said, Arise, Sir Gregor.
The rasping voice trailed off. He squatted silently before her, a hulking black shape, shrouded in night, hidden from her eyes. Sansa could hear his ragged breathing. She was sad for him, she realized. Somehow the fear had gone away. The silence went on and on, so long that she began to grow afraid once more. But she was afraid for him now, not for herself. She found his massive shoulder with her hand. He was no true knight, she whispered to him. The hound threw back his head and roared. Sansa stumbled back away from him, but he caught her arm.
No, he growled at her. No, little bird, he was no true knight.
The rest of the way into the city, Sandor Clegane said not a word. He led her to where the carts were waiting, told a driver to take them back to the Red Keep, and climbed in after her. They rode in silence through the King's Gate and up torchlit city streets. He opened the postern door and led her into the castle, his burned face twitching and his eyes brooding, and he was one step behind her as they climbed the tower stairs. He took her safe all the way
to the corridor outside her bedchamber.
"Thank you, my lord," Sansa said meekly.
The hound caught her by the arm and leaned close. "The things I told you tonight," he said, his voice sounding even rougher than usual. "If you ever tell Joffrey, your sister, your father, any of them..."
"I won't," Sansa whispered. I promise."
It was not enough. "If you ever tell anyone," he finished, "I'll kill you."
Eddard. "I stood last vigil for him myself," Sir Barristan Selmy said, as they looked down at the body in the back of the cart. "He had no one else. A mother in the Vale, I'm told." In the pale dawn light, the young knight looked as though he were sleeping. He had not been handsome, but death had smoothed his rough-hewn features, and the Silent Sisters had dressed him in his best velvet tunic, with a high collar, to cover the ruin the lance had made of his throat. Eddard Stark looked at his face and wondered if it had been for his sake that the boy had died. Slain by a Lannister bannerman before Ned could speak to him? Could that be mere happenstance? He supposed he would never know. "Hugh was John Arryn's squire for 4 years," Selmy went on. "The king knighted him before he rode north in John's memory. The lad wanted it desperately, yet I fear he was not ready." Ned had slept badly last night, and he felt tired beyond his years.
"None of us is ever ready," he said.
"For knighthood?"
"For death."
Gently, Ned covered the boy with his cloak, a blood-stained bit of blue, bordered in crescent moons. When his mother asked why her son was dead, he reflected bitterly, they would tell her they had fought to honour the king's hand, Eddard Stark. This was needless. "War should not be a game," Ned turned to the woman beside the cart, shrouded in grey, face hidden, but for her eyes. The Silent Sisters prepared men for the grave, and it was ill fortune to look on the face of death. "Send his armour home to the Vale. The mother will want to have it."
"It is worth a fair piece of silver," Sir Barristan said. "The boy had it forged special for the tourney. Plain work, but good. I do not know if he had finished paying the smith."
"He paid yesterday, my lord, and he paid dearly," Ned replied. And to the Silent Sister he said, "Send the mother the armour. I will deal with this smith." She bowed her head.
Afterwards, Sir Barristan walked with Ned to the king's pavilion. The camp was beginning to stir. Fat sausages sizzled and spit over fire pits, spicing the air with a sense of garlic and pepper. Young squires hurried about on errands as their masters woke, yawning and stretching to meet the day. A serving man with a goose under his arm bent his knee when he caught sight of them.
"My lords,"
he muttered, as the goose honked and pecked at his fingers. The shields displayed outside each tent heralded its occupant. The silver eagle, a sea guard. Bryce Caron's field of nightingales. A cluster of grapes for the red wines. Brindle boar, red ox, burning tree, white ram, triple spiral. Purple unicorn, dancing maiden, black adder, twin towers, horned owl, and last, the pure white blazons of the king's guard, shining like the dawn.
"The king means to fight in the melee today," Sir Barristan said, as they were passing Sir Meron's shield, its paint solid by a deep gash where Loras Tyrell's lance had scarred the wood as he drove him from his saddle.
"Yes," Ned said grimly.
Jory had woken him last night to bring him that news. Small wonder he had slept so badly. Sir Barristan's look was troubled.
"They say night's beauties fade at dawn, and the children of wine are oft disowned in the morning light."
"They say so," Ned agreed, "but not of Robert."
Other men might reconsider words spoken in drunken bravado, but Robert Baratheon would remember, and remembering would never back down. The king's pavilion was close by the water, and the morning mists of the river had wreathed it in wisps of grey. It was all of golden silk, the largest and grandest structure in the camp. Outside the entrance, Robert's war hammer was displayed beside an immense iron shield blazoned with the crown stag of House Baratheon. Ned had hoped to discover the king still abed in a wine-soaked sleep, but luck was not with him. They found Robert drinking beer from a polished horn and roaring his displeasure at two young squires who were trying to buckle him into his armour. "Your Grace," one was saying, almost in tears, "it's made too small, it won't go." He fumbled, and the gorget he was trying to fit around Robert's thick neck tumbled to the ground. "Seven hells," Robert swore. "Do I have to do it myself? Piss on the both of you. Pick it up. Don't just stand there gaping, Lancel. Pick it up." The lad jumped, and the king noticed his company. "Look at these oaths, Ned. My wife insisted I take these two to squire for me, and they're worse than useless. Can't even put a man's armour on properly. Squires, they say? I say they're swineherd dressed up in silk." Ned only needed a glance to understand the difficulty. "The boys are not at fault," he told the king. "You're too fat for your armour, Robert." Robert Baratheon took a long swallow of beer, tossed the empty horn onto his sleeping furs, wiped his mouth with the back of his hand, and said darkly, "Fat? Fat, is it? Is that how you speak to your king?" He let go his laughter, sudden as a storm. "Damn you, Ned, why are you always right?" The squire smiled nervously until the king turned on them. "You, yes, both of you. You heard the hand? The king is too fat for his armour. Go find Sir Aaron Sanigar. Tell him I need the breastplate stretcher. Now, what are you waiting for?" The boys tripped over each other in the haste to be quit of the tent. Robert managed to keep a stern face until they were gone. Then he dropped back in his chair, shaking with laughter. Sir Barristan Selmy chuckled with him. Even Eddard Stark managed a smile. Always, though, the graver thoughts crept in. He could not help taking note of the two squires. Handsome boys, fair and well-made. One was Sansa's age, with long golden curls, the other perhaps 15, sandy-haired, with a wisp of a moustache and the emerald-green eyes of the queen.
"I wish I could be there to see Sanagar's face," Robert said. "I hope he'll have the wit to send them to someone else. We ought to keep them running all day."
"Those boys," Ned asked him, "Lannisters?" Robert nodded, wiping tears from his eyes.
"Cousins, sons of Lord Tywin's brother. One of the dead ones, or perhaps the live one. Now that I come to think of it, I don't recall. My wife comes from a very large family, Ned."
A very ambitious family, Ned thought. He had nothing against the squires, but it troubled him to see Robert surrounded by the queen's kin, waking and sleeping. The Lannister appetite for offices and honours seemed to know no bounds. "The talk is you and the queen had angry words last night." The mirth curdled on Robert's face.
"The woman tried to forbid me to fight in the melee. She's sulking in the castle now, damn her. Your sister would never have shamed me like that."
"You never knew Lyanna as I did, Robert," Ned told him. "You saw her beauty, but not the iron underneath. She would have told you that you have no business in the melee."
"You too," the king frowned. "You're a sound man, Stark. Too long in the north. All the juices have frozen inside you. Well, mine are still running."
He slapped his chest to prove it. "You are the king," Ned reminded him.
"I sit on the damned iron seat where I must. Does that mean I don't have the same hungers as other men? A bit of wine now and again? A girl squealing in bed? The feel of a horse between my legs? Seven hells, Ned. I want to hit someone.
Sir Barristan Selmyr spoke up.
Your Grace, he said, it is not seemly that the king should ride into the melee. It would not be a fair contest. Who would dare strike you?
Robert seemed honestly taken aback.
Why, all of them, damn it, if they can. And the last man left standing
will be you, Ned finished.
He saw at once that Selmy had hit the mark. The dangers of the melee were only a savour to Robert, but this touched on his pride. Sir Barristan is right. There's not a man in the Seven Kingdoms who would dare risk your displeasure by hurting you. The king rose to his feet, his face flushed.
Are you telling me those prancing cravens will let me win?
For a certainty, Ned said, and Sir Barristan Selmy bowed his head in silent accord. For a moment Robert was so angry he could not speak. He strode across the tent, whirled, strode back, his face dark and angry. He snatched up his breastplate from the ground and threw it at Barristan Selmy in a wordless fury. Selmy dodged.
Get out, the king said then, coldly. Get out, before I kill you.
Sir Barristan left quickly. Ned was about to follow when the king called out again.
Not you, Ned.
Ned turned back. Robert took up his horn again, filled it with beer from a barrel in the corner, and thrust it at Ned.
Drink,
he said brusquely.
I've no thirst. Drink! Your king commands it.
Ned took the horn and drank. The beer was black and thick, so strong it stung the eyes. Robert sat down again.
Damn you, Ned Stark. You and John Aaron. I loved you both. What have you done to me? You were the one should have been king, you or John.
You had the better claim, Your Grace.
I told you to drink, not to argue. You made me king. You could at least have the courtesy to listen when I talk, damn you. Look at me, Ned. Look at what kinging has done to me. God's too fat for me armour. How did it ever come to this? Robert, drink and stay quiet. The king is talking. I swear to you, I was never so alive as when I was winning this throne, or so dead as now that I've won it. And seriously, I've John Aaron to thank for her. I had no wish to marry after Lyanna was taken from me, but John said the realm needed an heir. Cersei Lannister would be a good match, he told me. She would bind Lord Tywin to me, should Viserys Targaryen ever try to win back his father's throne.
The king shook his head.
I love that old man, I swear it, but now I think he was a bigger fool than Moon Boy. Oh, Cersei is lovely to look at, truly, but cold. Oh, the way she guards her cunt. You'd think she'd had all the gold of Casterly Rock between her legs. Here, give me that beer, if you won't drink it.
He took the horn, upended it, belched, wiped his mouth.
I'm sorry for your girl, Ned, truly. About the wolf, I mean. My son was lying. I'll stake my soul on that. My son... You love your children, don't you?
With all my heart, Ned said.
Let me tell you a secret, Ned. More than once, I've dreamed of giving up the crown. Take a ship for the free cities, with my horse, my hammer, spend my time warring and whoring. That's what I was made for. The sellsword king. How the singers would love me. You know what stops me? The thought of Joffrey on the throne, with Cersei standing behind him, whispering in his ear. My son! How could I have made a son like that, Ned?
He's only a boy, Ned said awkwardly. He had small liking for Prince Joffrey, but he could hear the pain in Robert's voice.
Have you forgotten how wild you were at his age?
It would not trouble me if the boy was wild, Ned. You don't know him as I do.
He sighed and shook his head.
Ah, perhaps you're right. John despaired of me often enough, yet I grew into a good king.
Robert looked at Ned and scowled at his silence.
You might speak up and agree now, you know.
Your Grace, Ned began carefully. Robert slapped Ned on the back.
Say I'm a better king than Ares, and be done with it. You never could lie for love nor honour, Ned Stark. I'm still young, and now that you're here with me, things will be different. We'll make this a reign to sing of, and damn the Lannisters to seven hells. I smell bacon. Who do you think our champion will be today? Have you seen Mace Tyrell's boy? The Knight of Flowers, they call him. Now there's a son any man would be proud to own to. Last tourney, he dumped the Kingslayer on his golden rump. You ought to have seen the look on Cersei's face. I laughed till my sides hurt. Renly says he has this sister, a maid of 14. Ooh, lovely as a dawn.
They broke their fast on black bread and boiled goose eggs and fish fried up with onions and bacon at a trestle table by the river's edge. The king's melancholy melted away with the morning mist, and before long Robert was eating an orange and waxing fond about a morning at the Eyrie when they had been boys.
I'd given John a barrel of oranges, remember? Only the things had gone rotten, so I flung mine across the table and hit Dax right on the nose. You remember Redford's pock-faced squire? It tossed one back at me, and before John could so much as fart, there were oranges flying across the high hall in every direction.
He laughed uproariously, and even Ned smiled, remembering. This was a boy he'd grown up with, he thought. This was the Robert Baratheon he'd known and loved. If he could prove that the Lannisters were behind the attack on Bran, prove that they had murdered John Arryn, this man would listen. Then Cersei would fall, and the Kingslayer with her. And if Lord Tywin dared to rouse the West, Robert would smash him as he had smashed Rhaegar Targaryen on the Trident. He could see it all so clearly. That breakfast tasted better than anything Eddard Stark had eaten in a long time. And afterward, his smile came easier and more often, until it was time for the tournament to resume. Ned walked with the king to the jousting field. He had promised to watch the final tilts with Sansa. Septa Mordane was ill today, and his daughter was determined not to miss the end of the jousting. As he saw Robert to his place, he noted that Cersei Lannister had chosen not to appear. The place beside the king was empty. That, too, gave Ned cause to hope. He shouldered his way to where his daughter was seated, and found her as the horns blew for the day's first joust. Sansa was so engrossed, she scarcely seemed to notice his arrival. Sandor Clegane was the first rider to appear. He wore an olive-green cloak over his soot-grey armour. That and his hound's head helm were his only concessions to ornament. 100 golden dragons on the Kingslayer, Littlefinger announced loudly, as Jaime Lannister entered the lists, riding an elegant blood-bay destrier. The horse wore a blanket of gilded ringmail, and Jaime glittered from head to heel. Even his lance was fashioned from the golden wood of the Summer Isles. "Done," Lord Renly shouted back. "The hound has a hungry look about him this morning." "Even hungry dogs know better than to bite the hand that feeds them," Littlefinger called dryly. Sandor Clegane dropped his visor with an audible clang and took up his position. Sir Jaime tossed a kiss to some woman in the commons, gently lowered his visor, and rode to the end of the lists. Both men couched their lances. Ned Stark would have loved nothing so much as to see them both lose, but Sansa was watching it all moist-eyed and eager. The hastily erected gallery trembled as the horses broke into a gallop. The hound leaned forward as he rode, his lance rock-steady. But Jaime shifted his seat deftly in the instant before impact. Clegane's point was turned harmlessly against the golden shield with the lion blazon, while his own hit square. Wood shattered, and the hound reeled, fighting to keep his seat. Sansa gasped, A ragged cheer went up from the commons.
"I wonder how I ought to spend your money," Littlefinger called down to Lord Renly.
The hound just managed to stay in the saddle. He jerked his mount around hard and rode back to the lists for the second pass. Jamie Lannister tossed down his broken lance and snatched up a fresh one, jesting with his squire. The hound spurred forward at a hard gallop. Lannister rode to meet him. This time, when Jamie shifted his seat, Sandor Clegane shifted with him. Both lances exploded. By the time the splinters had settled, a riderless blood bay was trotting off in search of grass, while Sir Jamie Lannister rolled in the dirt, golden and dented. Sansa said, "I knew the hound would win."
Littlefinger overheard. "If you know who's going to win the second match, speak up now, before Lord Renly plucks me clean," he called to her.
Ned smiled. "A pity the Emperor's not here with us," Lord Renly said. "I should have won twice as much." Jamie Lannister was back on his feet, but his ornate lion helmet had been twisted around and dented in his fall, and now he could not get it off. The commons were hooting and pointing, the lords and ladies were trying to stifle their chuckles and failing, and over it all, Ned could hear King Robert laughing louder than anyone. Finally, they had to lead the Lion of Lannister off to a blacksmith, blind and stumbling. By then, Sir Gregor Clegane was in position at the head of the lists. He was huge, the biggest man that Eddard Stark had ever seen. Robert Baratheon and his brothers were all big men, as was the Hound, and back at Winterfell there was a simple-minded stable boy named Hodor, who dwarfed them all. But the knight they called the Mountain That Rides would have towered over Hodor. He was well over 7 feet tall, closer to 8, with massive shoulders and arms as thick as the trunks of small trees. His gesture seemed a pony in between his armored legs, and the lance he carried looked as small as a broom handle. Unlike his brother, Sir Gregor did not live at court. He was a solitary man who seldom left his own lands but for wars and tourneys. He had been with Lord Tywin when King's Landing fell, a new-made knight of 17 years, even then distinguished by his size and his implacable ferocity. Some said it had been Gregor who dashed the skull of the infant prince Aegon Targaryen against a wall, and whispered that afterwards he had raped the mother, the Dornish princess Elia, before putting her to the sword. These things were not said in Gregor's hearing. Ned Stark could not recall ever speaking to the man, though Gregor had ridden with them during Balon Greyjoy's rebellion, one night among thousands. He watched them with disquiet. Ned seldom put much stock in gossip, but the things said of Sir Gregor were more than ominous. He was soon to be married for the third time, and one heard dark whisperings about the deaths of his first two wives. It was said that his keep was a grim place, where servants disappeared unaccountably, and even the dogs were afraid to enter the hall. And there had been a sister, who had died young under queer circumstances, and the fire that had disfigured his brother, and the hunting accident that had killed their father. Gregor had inherited the keep, the gold, and the family estates. His younger brother, Sandor, had left the same day to take service with the Lannisters as a sworn sword, and it was said that he had never returned, not even to visit. When the Knight of Flowers made his entrance, a murmur ran through the crowd, and he heard Sansa's fervent whisper, "Oh, he's so beautiful!" Sir Loras Tyrell was slender as a reed, dressed in a suit of fabulous silver armour, polished to a blinding sheen, and filigreed with twining black vines and tiny blue forget-me-nots. The commons realized, in the same instant as Ned, that the blue of the flowers came from sapphires. A gasp went up from a thousand throats. Across the boy's shoulders, his cloak hung heavy. It was woven of forget-me-nots, real ones, hundreds of fresh blooms sewn into a heavy woolen cape. His courser was as slim as her rider, a beautiful grey mare, built for speed. Sir Gregor's huge stallion trumpeted as he caught her scent. The boy from High Garden did something with his legs, and his horse pranced sideways, nimble as a dancer. Sansa clutched at his arm. "Father, don't let Sir Gregor hurt him," she said. Ned saw she was wearing the rose that Sir Loras had given her yesterday. Jorry had told him about that as well. "These are tawny lances," he told his daughter. "They make them to splinter on impact, so no one is hurt." Yet he remembered the dead boy in the cart, with his cloak of crescent moons, and the words were raw in his throat. Sir Gregor was having trouble controlling his horse. The stallion was screaming and pawing the ground, shaking his head. The mountain kicked at the animal savagely with an armored boot. The horse reared and almost threw him. The Knight of Flowers saluted the king, rode to the far end of the list, and couched his lance ready. Sir Gregor brought his animal to the line, fighting with the reins, and suddenly it began. The mountain stallion broke into a hard gallop, plunging forward wildly, while the mare charged as smooth as a flow of silk. Sir Gregor wrenched his shield into position, juggling with his lance, and all the while fought to hold his unruly mount on a straight line, and suddenly Loras Tyrell was on him, placing the point of his lance just there, and in an eye-blink the mountain was falling. He was so huge that he took his horse down with him in a tangle of steel and flesh. Ned heard applause, cheers, whistles, shocked gasps, excited muttering, and over it all the rasping, raucous laughter of the hound. The Knight of Flowers reined up at the end of the list. His lance was not even broken. His sapphires winked in the sun as he raised his visor, smiling. The commons went mad for him. In the middle of the field, Sir Gregor Clegane disentangled himself and came boiling to his feet. He wrenched off his helm and slammed it down onto the ground. His face was dark with fury, and his hair fell down into his eyes. "My sword!" he shouted to his squire, and the boy ran it out to him. By then his stallion was back on his feet as well. Gregor Clegane killed the horse with a single blow of such ferocity that it half-severed the animal's neck. Cheers turned to shrieks in a heartbeat. The stallion went down to its knees, screaming as it died. By then Gregor was striding down the lists towards Sir Loras Tyrell, his bloody sword clutched in his fist. "Stop him!" Ned shouted, but his words were lost in the roar. Everyone else was yelling as well, and Sansa was crying. It all happened so fast. The Knight of Flowers was shouting for his own sword as Sir Gregor knocked his squire aside and made a grab for the reins of his horse. The mare scented blood and reared. Loras Tyrell kept his seat, but barely. Sir Gregor swung his sword, a savage two-handed blow that took the boy in the chest and knocked him from his saddle. The courser dashed away in panic, as Sir Loras lay stunned in the dirt. But as Gregor lifted his sword for the killing blow, a rasping voice warned, "Leave him be!" And a steel-clad hand wrenched him away from the boy. The mountain pivoted in wordless fury, swinging his longsword in a killing arc with all his massive strength behind it. But the hound caught the blow and turned it, and for what seemed an eternity the two brothers stood hammering at each other as a dazed Loras Tyrell was helped to safety. Thrice Ned saw Sir Gregor aim savage blows at the hound's head helmet, yet not once did Sandor send a cut at his brother's unprotected face. It was the king's voice that put an end to it. The king's voice and 20 swords. John Aaron had told them that a commander needs a good battlefield voice, and Robert had proved the truth of that on the Trident. He used that voice now. "Stop this madness!" he boomed. "In the name of your king!" The hound went to one knee. Sir Gregor's blow cut air, and at last he came to his senses. He dropped his sword and glared at Robert. Surrounded by his king's guard and a dozen other knights and guardsmen. Wordlessly, he turned and strode off, shoving past Barristan Selmy. "Let him go," Robert said, and as quickly as that, it was over. "Is the hound the champion now?" Sansa asked Ned. "No," he told her. "There will be one final joust between the hound and the Knight of Flowers." But Sansa had the right of it after all. A few moments later, Sir Loras Tyrell walked back onto the field in a simple linen doublet and said to Sandor Clegane, "I owe you my life. The day is yours, sir." "I'm no sir," the hound replied, but he took the victory and the champion's purse, and for perhaps the first time in his life, the love of the commons. They cheered him as he left the lists to return to his pavilion. As Ned walked with Sansa to the archery field, Littlefinger and Lord Renly and some of the others fell in with them. "Tyrell had to know the mayor was in heat," Littlefinger was saying. "I swear the boy planned the whole thing. Gregor has always favoured huge, ill-tempered stallions with more spirit than sense." The notion seemed to amuse him. It did not amuse Sir Barristan Selmy. "There is small honour in tricks," the old man said stiffly. "Small honour and 20,000 golds, Lord Renly smiled. That afternoon, a boy named Angai, an unheralded commoner from the Dornish Marches, won the archery competition, outshooting Sir Balon Swan and Jalabar Zoe at 100 paces after all the other bowmen had been eliminated at the shorter distances. Ned sent Alan to see him out and offer him a position with the hands guard, but the boy was flush with wine and victory and riches undreamed of, and he refused. The melee went on for 3 hours. Nearly 40 men took part, free riders and hedge knights, new-made squires in search of a reputation. They fought with blunted weapons in a chaos of mud and blood, small troops fighting together and then turning on each other as alliances formed and fractured, until only one man was left standing. The victor was the Red Priest, Thoros of Myr, a madman who shaved his head and fought with a flaming sword. He had won melees before. The fire sword frightened the mounts of the other riders, and nothing frightened Thoros. The final tally was 3 broken limbs, a shattered collarbone, 12 smashed fingers, 2 horses that had to be put down, and more cuts, sprains, and bruises than anyone cared to count. Ned was desperately pleased that Robert had not taken part. That night, at the feast, Eddard Stark was more hopeful than he had been in a great while. Robert was in a high good humour, the Lannisters were nowhere to be seen, and even his daughters were behaving. Jorry brought Arya down to join them, and Sansa spoke to her sister pleasantly. "The tournament was magnificent," she sighed. "You should have come. How was your dancing?" "I'm sore all over," Arya reported happily, proudly displaying a huge purple bruise on her leg. "You must be a terrible dancer," Sansa said doubtfully. Later, while Sansa was off listening to a troupe of singers perform the complex round of interwoven ballads called the Dance of the Dragons, Ned inspected the bruise himself. "I hope Pharrell is not being too hard on you," he said. Arya stood on one leg. She was getting much better at that of late. "Sirio says that every hurt is a lesson, and every lesson makes you better." Ned frowned. The man, Sirio Pharrell, had come with an excellent reputation, and his flamboyant, bravassi style was well suited to Arya's slender blade, yet still. A few days ago she had been wandering round with a swatch of black silk tied over her eyes. Sirio was teaching her to see with her ears and her nose and her skin, she told him. Before that, he had her doing spins and backflips. "Arya, are you certain you want to persist in this?" She nodded. "Tomorrow, we're going to catch cats." "Cats?" Ned sighed. "Perhaps it was a mistake to hire this bravassi. If you like, I will ask Jory to take over your lessons, or I might have a quiet word with Sir Barristan. He was the finest sword in the Seven Kingdoms in his youth. I don't want them, Arya said. I want Syria. Ned ran his fingers through his hair. Any decent master-at-arms could give Arya the rudiments of slash and parry without this nonsense of blindfolds, cartwheels, and hopping around on one leg. But he knew his youngest daughter well enough to know there was no arguing with that stubborn jut of jaw. As you wish, he said. Surely she would grow tired of this soon. Try to be careful. I will, she promised solemnly, as she hopped smoothly from a right leg to a left.
Much later, after he'd taken the girls back through the city and seen them both safe in bed, Sansa with her dreams and Arya with her bruises, Ned ascended to his own chamber atop the Tower of the Hand. The day had been warm, and the room was close and stuffy. Ned went to the window and unfastened the heavy shutters to let in the cool night air. Across the great yard, he noticed the flickering glow of candlelight from Littlefinger's windows. The hour was well past midnight. Down by the river, the rebels were only now beginning to dwindle and die. He took out the dagger and studied it. Littlefinger's blade, won by Tyrion Lannister in a tawny wager. Sent to slay Bran in his sleep? Why? Why would the dwarf want Bran dead? Why would anyone want Bran dead? The dagger, Bran's fall, all of it was linked somehow to the murder of John Arryn. He could feel it in his gut, but the truth of John's death remained as clouded to him as when he had started. Lord Stannis had not returned to King's Landing for the tourney. Lysa Arryn held her silence behind the high walls of the Eyrie. The squire was dead, and Jory was still searching the whorehouses. What did he have but Robert's bastard? That the armourer's sullen apprentice was the king's son, Ned had no doubt. The Baratheon look was stamped on his face, in his jaw, his eyes, that black hair. Renly was too young to have fathered a boy of that age. Stannis, too cold and proud in his honour. Gendry had to be Robert's. Yet knowing all that, what had he learned? The king had other base-born children scattered throughout the Seven Kingdoms. He had openly acknowledged one of his bastards, a boy of Bran's age, whose mother was high-born. The lad was being fostered by Lord Renly's castellan at Storm's End. Ned remembered Robert's first child as well, a daughter, born in the Vale when Robert was scarcely more than a boy himself. A sweet little girl. The young lord of Storm's End had doted on her. He used to make daily visits to play with the babe long after he'd lost interest in the mother. Ned was often dragged along for company, whether he willed it or not. The girl would be 17 or 18 now, he realized, older than Robert had been when he fathered her. Strange thought. Cersei could not have been pleased by her lord husband's byblows, yet in the end it mattered little whether the king had one bastard or 100. Law and custom gave the base-born few rights. Gendry, the girl in the Vale, the boy at Storm's End, none of them could threaten Robert's true-born children. His musings were ended by a soft rap on his door. "A man to see you, my lord," Harbin called. "He will not give his name." "Send him in," Ned said, wondering. The visitor was a stout man in cracked, mud-caked boots and a heavy brown robe of the coarsest roughspun, his features hidden by a cowl, his hands drawn up in voluminous sleeves. "Who are you?" Ned asked. "A friend," the cowl man said in a strange, low voice. "We must speak alone, Lord Stark." Curiosity was stronger than caution. "Harwin, leave us," he commanded. Not until they were alone behind closed doors did the visitor draw back his cowl. "Lord Varys," Ned said in astonishment. "Lord Stark," Varys said politely, seating himself. "I wonder if I might trouble you for a drink." Ned filled two cups with summer wine and handed one to Varys. "I might have passed within a foot of you and never recognized you," he said, incredulous. He had never seen the eunuch dress in anything but silk and velvet and the richest damasks, and this man smelled of sweat instead of lilacs.
"That was my dearest hope," Vara said. "It would not do if certain people learned that we had spoken in private. The Queen watches you closely. His wine is very choice, thank you."
"How did you get past my other guards?" Ned said. Porter and Kane had been posted outside the tower, and Alan on the stairs.
"The Red Keep has ways known only to ghosts and spiders."
Vary smiled apologetically.
I will not keep you long, my lord. There are things you must know. You are the king's hand, and the king is a fool."
The eunuch's cloying tones were gone. Now his voice was thin and sharp as a whip.
"Your friend, I know, yet a fool, nonetheless, and doomed, unless you save him. Today was a near thing. They had hoped to kill him during the melee."
For a moment Ned was speechless with shock.
"Who?" Varys sipped his wine. "If I truly need to tell you that, you are a bigger fool than Robert, and I am on the wrong side."
"The Lannisters?" Ned said. "The Queen? No, I will not believe that. Not even of Cersei. She asked him not to fight."
"She forbade him to fight. In front of his brother, his knights, and half the court. Tell me truly, do you know any surer way to force King Robert into the melee, I ask you?"
Ned had the sick feeling in his gut. The eunuch had hit upon a truth. Tell Robert Baratheon he could not, should not, or must not do a thing, and it was as good as done. Even if he'd fought, who would have dared to strike the king?
Varys shrugged. "There were 40 riders in the melee. The Lannisters have many friends. Amidst all that chaos, with horses screaming and bones breaking and forests of myrrh waving that absurd fire sword of his, who could name it murder if some chance blow failed his grace?"
He went to the flagon and refilled his cup.
"After the deed was done, the slayer would be beside himself with grief. I can almost hear him weeping, so sad. Yet no doubt the gracious and compassionate widow would take pity, lift the poor unfortunate to his feet, and bless him with a gentle kiss of forgiveness. Good King Joffrey would have no choice but to pardon him."
The eunuch stroked his cheek.
"Or perhaps Cersei would let Sir Ilion strike off his head. Less risk for the Lannisters that way, though quite an unpleasant surprise for their little friend."
Ned felt his anger rise.
"You knew of this plot, and you did nothing. I command whisperers, not warriors. You might have come to me earlier. Oh, yes, I confess it. And you would have rushed straight to the king, yes? And when Robert heard of his peril, what would he have done, I wonder?"
Ned considered that.
"He would have damned them all, and fought anyway, to show he did not fear them."
Varys spread his hands.
"I will make another confession, Lord Eddard. I was curious to see what you would do." "Why not come to me, you ask, and I must answer, why? Because I did not trust you, my lord."
"You did not trust me?" Ned was frankly astonished. "The Red Keep shelters two sorts of people, Lord Eddard," Varys said.
"Those who are loyal to the realm, and those who are loyal only to themselves. Until this morning, I could not say which you might be. So I waited to see, and now I know for a certainty."
He smiled a plump, tight-little smile, and for a moment his private face and public mask were one.
"I begin to comprehend why the Queen fears you so much. Oh, yes, I do."
"You are the one she ought to fear," Ned said.
"No, I am what I am. The King makes use of me, but it shames him. A most puissant warrior is our Robert, and such a manly man has little love for sneaks and spies and eunuchs. If a day should come when Cersei whispers, 'Kill that man,' Ilion Payne will sneak off my head in a twinkling. And who will mourn poor Varys then?" North or south, they sing no songs for spiders."
He reached out and touched Ned with a soft hand. "But you, Lord Stark?"
"I think no."